Hello again, and welcome back to Celluloid Jelly, a podcast featuring a couple of ex-video store guys who just love talking about movies. I'm CJ Talbot. Joining me as always will be my co-host, Cesar Alejandro Jr. from Filmsmash.com. For this episode, we're discussing 1955's East of Eden, directed by Elia Kazan. All right, we're back. Here we go. How we doing, Cesar?
I think I'm doing okay. Want to apologize for the length of time between our previous podcast and this recording. Some unforeseen circumstances, health-related, kind of popped up to keep us from putting this out in a timely fashion.
It's no problem.
As much an apology to you as it is to all the listeners out there.
You don't have to apologize to me. It's no problem at all.
Yeah.
So, what's going on? What was our last episode?
It was Gremlins, yeah?
Yeah, that was for Christmas.
So, I'm pretty sure we didn't record anything after that.
Yeah, it was Gremlins and Last Jedi.
Okay.
Yeah. Which I've now seen three times.
Last Jedi?
Yeah, Chelsea's brother came out to California last week, and he hadn't seen it yet, so we took him to see it.
Okay. So. Yeah, I'm still at my two, so. There's other films I should probably watch before watching Last Jedi another time.
There's a lot of films you need to watch.
Can we just do a podcast about, like, Jackie Chan movies?
Yeah. Let's do Rumble in the Bronx. Come on.
Wouldn't even need to prepare. Well, I'd have to send you a copy, because the only copies that are available for streaming or purchase in the United States are the edited versions.
Of Rumble in the Bronx?
Yes.
All right. Well, what about, like, Rush Hour 3? We'll do that one.
Oh, man. Roman Polanski? All right. Roman Polanski, finally.
We might have talked about this on one of our previous episodes, but he had a movie out this year called The Foreigner, which was pretty good. Solid. I liked it.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
It came out in, what, October or so?
Well, I think you saw it a couple weeks before I did. I caught it as a matinee, like, at least two or three weeks after it had been out in theaters.
Okay. So. It was not opening night, but opening weekend viewing for me.
Yeah, well, it's Jackie Chan, so I expect nothing less. When that man eventually, you know, kicks the bucket, you will be destroyed.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think,
that's not going to happen anytime soon, though, so.
Hopefully not.
he's still got you know, 18 or 20 more movies than him.
Yeah. He's got three more coming out this year.
There you go. So he's a workhorse. So have you watched anything? We're going to hopefully do a 2017 favorites episode next week. So a lot of the movies that I've been watching recently have been sort of like playing catch up and rewatching some of my favorites so that I can kind of talk about them. Has there been anything non-2017 related that you've watched recently that you want to talk about real quick?
Non-2017 related?
Yeah.
I don't know. I wasn't really prepared for that question.
I like to keep you off balance.
I've only been to the theater once this year, but it was to watch a 2017 film.
Wait, that's not true, is it?
Yeah, I've only been to the theater once. I've been super busy.
You mean in January? Like, you mean 2018, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I'm like, I'm pretty sure we saw movies together before I left Baltimore.
I'm living in the past, CJ.
It's fine.
Okay, well, I mean, I guess about a week ago, I rewatched Fire and Ice, the Ralph Bakshi and Frank Frazetta collaboration film.
Okay.
It'd probably been close to 20 years, I think.
That's like the caveman one, right?
Yeah. You know, prehistoric people and, like, wizardry and, I guess, like, dragons and stuff, and all, like, this guy named Darkwolf, who I remembered his name going to the film, but watching it, I realized they never ever say his name in the movie. He's just this guy with like who's wearing like a wolf carcass on his head. And he is badass.
I've never seen it. I do remember the DVD cover, so I know exactly what you're talking about, though.
Yeah. Yeah, so I guess he's pretty much like the one of like the... He's like the Terminator, almost, in this movie. So he kind of shows up to kind of save the day. Like, one thing I think is really funny, like, he's not technically the hero, but he's obviously the badass of the film. There's a scene where he's helping the... I guess the actual lead, who has a romantic reason that he's trying to break into like this evil kingdom, and there's a group of I guess like evil like cavemen who are being used as like the workforce or like the militant force of this evil dictator, and they're all sleeping, and obviously you'd think that the easiest way to kind of dispatch this group of like you know easy targets is to just walk up to them one at a time, you know, slit their throats in their sleep and be on with it, move on to the next. Instead of that, there's like 30 of them. He jumps into the middle of them, yells, and proceeds to kind of hack and slash them with like a giant like axe. It's like, no trouble, whatever.
It's like, I don't have higher functions in my brain. I'm a Neanderthal.
He's not. He's... He's like William F. Buckley. I don't know.
Like that just reminds me of like Anchorman, like the bear fight scene.
No. Bear fight. I hear their menstruation.
Panda watch. The mood is tense.
Get out of here, stupid panda jerk.
Sorry, I didn't mean to derail you.
It's okay. I'm pretty much done talking about Fire and Ice.
So, I mean, you liked it, though? Was it good? Can I, you know, should I watch it?
Yeah, I think certain. I mean, it's a short film. I want to say, I can't remember exactly how long, but I'd say probably around, like, less than 80 minutes, probably.
Yeah.
So it's a quick watch. It's beautifully animated. They use rotoscope, which I know is kind of divisive in with people who are animation fans. I think it looks beautiful. The fluidity of motion that exists in it is not something that's very typical of even a lot of like 3D films today. So it's a beautiful movie, great backgrounds. The voice acting isn't great. The storyline is pretty generic. I think Frank Frazetta is actually pretty well known for doing a piece of art and a story being crafted around the art that he crafts. So, I mean, with the story being less of emphasis compared to visual splendor, I think the movie kind of falls into, like, what he's most well known for. But, you know, it's quick. I saw it on Amazon Prime, so it's a, it was a fun watch, definitely.
Cool. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. Awesome.
How about you? What have you watched recently?
Not much at all.
Oh, yeah?
Well, you know, I mean, to be honest, work's made it a little bit difficult to watch movies, like, at night, like, after I get home, because I'm getting home pretty late.
Yeah.
So, I'm a little behind. There are things that I want to watch that I haven't. And as far as 2018 releases in theaters, I've seen very few of them.
Yeah. The one movie I saw... in theaters this year so far was a 2017 film, but it was a Japanese film, but it had its theatrical run in the U.S. start earlier this month.
Yeah.
So it was a movie called Gintama, but I didn't want to bring that up because it didn't fall into, you said no 2017, so.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, the only thing I've been doing besides, catching up on 2017 is I'm still rewatching The West Wing, so I've been hitting that pretty hard.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, if I don't have time to watch a movie at night, you know, it's easier to watch a 47-minute episode of The West Wing on Netflix than it is to put in a 2-hour movie when it's 2:00 in the morning.
Yeah, I've been trying to stay pretty good on my movie watching. I think I fell a little bit behind just now.
Yeah. There's still a handful of things I want to see before we talk next week. So I'm hoping to catch Mudbound, which I haven't seen yet. Mm-hmm. And Call Me by Your Name, which just expanded into theaters nationwide.
Okay.
So we hadn't had a chance to go and see that in LA yet. So.
What's that one about?
Call Me by Your Name is the one with Timothy Chalamet and Armie Hammer. It's a period piece about a teenage boy who sort of has has an affair with his father's friend. And Armie Hammer plays the friend. And sort of like, you know, it's like...
Oh, you know, I have seen the trailer for that.
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, the
I saw the trailer months ago, though, so it wasn't...
Sexual awakening, coming-of-age story kind of thing, it looks like, at least, so...
Like Lolita.
Well, I don't know if I'd go that far. I don't know if Armie Hammer is the new Humbert, but we'll find out. I'll let you know. I'll let you know next week.
Like, maybe like The Lover, I guess. I don't know. Let's see.
Yeah, I was thinking more like Summer of 42.
I've never seen that, so
that's a good
one. You can only like reference what I've seen.
But yeah, so we're gonna. You know, we're going to dive into East of Eden, which was my pick. And I got to be honest, this was something that I sort of blind bought out of the bargain bin at Suncoast a while ago. And I'd never watched it. And I'm woefully undereducated on Elia Kazan films. And I had never seen a James Dean movie. I had seen pieces of all of his movies. But I've never sat down and watched any of them.
You know, it's funny you say that because for years I was sure I'd seen East of Eden. Watching this film again, the first thing that went through my head is that I've probably only seen like 75% of the film. Okay. Because there are bits at the very end and the very beginning of the film that I did not recall. So somehow, somewhere, I watched like a good portion of the film, but only in the middle of the movie.
Okay.
Unless, you know, the intro and ending pieces totally escaped me.
Yeah, well, I was a little worried because this is the first movie that we've done where neither one of us had sort of like, you know, really were like, oh, this is a great movie, we should do this for the episode. I mean, East of Eden is generally considered to be a classic, but I was a little worried because it was, you know, something that I hadn't seen, and it was my pick, so I was hoping that we weren't gonna just like have a terrible episode of both of us going, I don't really like this movie, let's move on.
Well, I don't know that. I think you might have a lot more to discuss if it's something we both disliked. So
maybe, yeah. But so your experience with the film is that you had seen it but didn't remember all of it, or maybe just seen part of it, maybe on TV or something like that.
Yeah, I guess like memory for me, especially these days, I kind of feel like I can't trust my memory as much as I used to. But yeah, I think that's a pretty good way to break it down for my experience with the movie.
Well, having never seen it, you know, probably like many of our listeners, you know, this is based on a book by John Steinbeck, made in 1955, directed by Elia Kazan, and the story is the story for the movie is taken from like the last half of Steinbeck's book. Steinbeck's book goes into much more detail about the relationship of the parents earlier in the first half. And Kazan essentially just took the second half and made it into a movie. It takes place in 1917, Monterey, California, and it's about a boy named Cal Trask, played by James Dean, who is a little bit different, doesn't have a good relationship with his father, feels a little bit alienated from him, that they don't have much in common. His father is deeply religious and is very forceful about pushing that on both of his sons. The other son, Aaron, played by Richard Davalos, we'll go with that, is much more the favorite son. He does more to please the father. He's your typical sort of good-looking hunkish. Like, he looks like he would be, a pinup of the day, whereas James Dean is considered to be, a very good-looking guy, but he doesn't have a very traditional, like, square jaw good look. It's very different. So Cal, before the movie begins, Cal discovers that his mother, who he and Aaron have both thought was dead, is actually alive and living in, where is it? The Shore Town. It's, Monterey is where she is, and they live in Salinas. Yeah, that's right. So he goes to visit her. Turns out she's the town madam, and she doesn't want to have anything to do with him, and so it causes friction and the breakdown of the family and more. So there we go. I'm going to stop there because I'm sort of bumbling through this, but...
It's okay.
So what were your impressions of the film upon seeing it again this time?
The film definitely runs at... kind of like a moderate pace. I think things get revealed very slowly. I've never read the novel, which is the basis of the film. So, like I said, the beginning of the movie wasn't something I necessarily remember. Like, I don't recall James Dean's character, Cal, following his mother. I think, honestly, I don't remember his mother at all until... he goes back the second time into her brothel or gambling house, which I guess was probably about 20 or 30 minutes in. Overall, like, the movie is... The 50s had a very different style of acting than what you'll see on screen these days. There was almost like a weird theatricality of it, which isn't uncommon for people who watch movies from this era. But I definitely thought that, like, for James Dean, he seemed way more emotional in his portrayal than I really remembered or expected.
Yeah, well, you're definitely right. But I think, you know, the stiffness of, say, like, 1920s, 30s, and 40s films, you know, when you look at films from that era, the Silver Age... there's much more of a stiffness, a hit your mark, say your line, kind of a thing. And in the 50s, you're right, there was a much more focused on bringing the theater into movies. And so, like, the acting got better, but it didn't become naturalistic. But it was certainly not, it was a step forward from where they were sort of like in the 30s and 40s in many cases. As far as staging and things like that go. But yeah, James Dean was part of the Method, sort of the actor studio out of New York, which Kazan was involved in and Lee Strasberg ran. And this movie comes out a few years after Marlon Brando had really hit it big and created the sensation, you know, of Method acting. So Dean... you know, apparently looked up and worshipped Marlon Brando, and he was sort of like the second wave of this. You know, like, Brando hit, and then James Dean and Montgomery Clift, and then you get into like Rod Steiger and guys like that. But yes, yeah, so, like, Dean's very... an unpredictability to, like, what he's doing in a lot of the scenes, which I think is good. Some of it feels very mannered to me, though, but at the time, I can understand how it was incredibly revolutionary. That opening scene that you're talking about with him following his mother, I thought that was an incredibly odd way to open the movie, considering the type of film that this is, because the music cues and the way it's shot, it first of all feels very Western-y. 1917 Monterey, California, with the exception of like the motorized cars and the electricity and things like that, it almost has the feel of an old West town.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty dusty. I don't really know if seaside towns were similar, all looked similar to that. But yeah, you didn't really have paved streets. It was dirt roads. Definitely not like, I guess, urbanized or metropolitan in any respect.
Yeah. But that scene, like the way it's shot and the music cues definitely lead you to believe that like something weird is going on. Like there's a real mysterious quality to it, which I like, but like given the sort of like melodrama of the film, it's almost an odd choice. You know what I mean?
Maybe, I have to say, I'm going to say this right now. It's been about 2 weeks since I've seen this movie. Like, the music cues aren't necessarily sticking out in my head right now.
That's okay. That's all right. But yeah, I mean, this movie... I don't know if you want to get into anything specific, but like just in general, this is like super melodramatic, very kind of soap opera-y in a way, sort of like the way like Peyton Place and things like that would be a little bit later down the road. But there are touches of real, like there's an underbelly of darkness to it, and that's the thing that I sort of like, you know, because I'm a big, you know, crime film and film noir kind of guy. So, like, that's the thing that I sort of, like, keyed in on and really, like, enjoyed about this. So, some of the shots when he's in Kate's place, Kate is the mother, when he kind of sneaks around Kate's place, there's a lot of like elongated shadows and things like that, which I really thought were cool. Especially later, and obviously, spoiler warning, if you haven't seen East of Eden, we're going to talk about everything. So either watch it first or just be aware that we're going to spoil the shit out of it.
Pretty late warning.
Yeah. So like once he discovers that his mother's alive, he keeps it a secret from his brother, but he does confront his father about it. And we'll come back to that in a second. But later in the film, sort of like in the climax of the movie, he and his brother have an argument. He falls in love with his brother's girlfriend. We'll get more into that, I assume, in a second as well. So he decides he's going to hurt his brother. And in order to hurt his brother, he's going to take him to see his mother. And that scene is probably like my favorite scene in the movie.
When he's kind of slowly.
Yeah, that whole sequence where like.
In the yard, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Abra and Cal. Abra is the girlfriend, played by Julie Harris, who, to be honest, I don't really connect with her in this movie much at all. But she's fantastic in Robert Wise's The Haunting. So if you ever want to see a great, great movie, horror movie, black and white horror movie, watch The Haunting, and she's really great in it. And she came out of the actor's studio as well. She plays Abra, and she is Aaron's girlfriend. And throughout the film, she and Cal sort of... develop a relationship of their own that neither one of them sort of initiate. It just sort of happens. There's an attraction there, and so they fall in love. When he decides to hurt Aaron, there's a scene where Cal and Abra are in the backyard of the home, and they're divided by like what is it like a linens, right?
Yeah, I guess they're
and like the bot. Yeah, like there's the bottom of a tree, a low-hanging tree, and some linens, and you can only see their legs as they're talking. And then Aaron comes out, and Cal gets upset, and he takes Aaron to see their mother. And when they get there, he sort of, in a really sort of violent, almost sexualized way, he sort of pushes Aaron on top of their mother and leaves. And as he leaves, like, he just walks out really slowly, and there's a terrific elongated shadow that comes right out of, like, you know, the chiaroscuro lighting of, like, film noirs. So, like, that's, you know, that image sticks out in my mind as, like, one of the great images of the movie.
Yeah. It's a super violent scene too. Like, I remember being shocked because it kind of looked like his mother would, like, hit her head on something. So I thought, you know, like I said, I didn't really remember the ending either. So I wasn't sure if she had been hurt, and that would have been like his revenge. He lost his mother a second time, but that's a pretty shocking and memorable scene, certainly.
Yeah, it's funny because like the relationship that he develops with his mother throughout the film, yeah, she doesn't want to have anything to do with him. And then finally she sort of like, he just keeps showing up and hanging around, and eventually she, you know, kind of opens up and lets him in. And they have that terrific, beautiful scene where...
When he goes to ask her for money?
Yeah, but like, he's following her and she sort of gives him like she kind of tilts her head and acknowledges like, okay, come on over here, you know, you can come over and we'll talk. And they start to walk, but like it's shot in like with a fog filter, so it you know, it, I don't know, it just has like a really dreamy, surreal quality to it. And that's another, you know, gorgeous image in the film is that scene of them.
Yeah, them walking towards us.
Yeah, and they sort of find common ground through the dialogue and see things about each other that they recognize within themselves. You know, it's a mother and a son, so there's obviously going to be those traits. And the scene basically ends where, you know, he's breaking down her walls and she's sort of becoming a little endearing, you know, to him. And then, you know, he's like, well, I need $5,000. And the look on her face is priceless. It really is.
Here it is.
But then the next scene, you know, when she takes him into her office and they continue their discussion, and she's a businesswoman. She looks at it in a very calculated fashion. And he explains, you know, that he wants to, you know, raise beans because the war is coming and beans are supposed to go through the roof and he's going to make a lot of money. And he intends to use that money to pay back his father for what his father lost on a lettuce venture, where he tried to use ice to refrigerate train cars to keep lettuce fresh from the West Coast to the East Coast.
Doesn't that sound absolutely ridiculous, like, saying that out loud?
Well, you know what's funny is, and we're jumping all around, but I don't give a shit. I looked up, I Googled, like, refrigerated, like, boxcars, and they, like, there were two different companies, at least, that had refrigerated train cars, like, a decade before this takes place. So in the movie, they act like it's a brand new idea that nobody's ever done. But, you know,
I guess Salinas is out in the boonies.
Yeah, that's what, like, I kind of thought about it, and I was like, well, this isn't the internet age. You know, I wanted to find out about refrigerated boxcars, so I just pulled out my laptop and Googled it. But you couldn't do that then. You know, unless somebody in your town knew about it, or unless the company that owned those refrigerated boxcars used trains on the tracks that went to Salinas, they probably wouldn't know about it. So he had a parallel idea, essentially, with other people, and he was not able to execute it well, and he lost pretty much all of his money. And the idea that Cal wants to make it back for him is, especially given the relationship that they have, which is very contentious, and the father, you know, he obviously loves Cal, but he doesn't understand Cal. And he he's the type of person who tries to mold his son into the person he wants him to be instead of allowing him to become the man that he would naturally be on his own. And that's where a lot of the tension and friction comes in. But so Cal wants to make back the money and win his father's love, essentially. You know, even later in the movie, he even says, "I tried to buy your love, with this money." So I guess going all the way back to the scene with Kate, the mother, you know, once he explains what he wants to do and get into Beans to bank money back for his father, as a businesswoman, she recognizes that he's in business with the right person, who is, I can't remember the guy's name, Will Hamilton, played by Albert Dekker.
Yeah, she has that throwaway line where it says he's a good businessman or something.
Yeah. Well, and we get a sense of that, too. He's the guy who sells Adam Trask, the father, the ice house in order to do the lettuce venture, which is a scene early in the film. Which also has that great shot of James Dean sort of having like a fit. Once, I don't know, this requires a lot of explanation, but whatever. once he buys the ice house, Cal and Aaron and Abra are all there, and Cal's up in the ice house, and then Aaron and Abra go up there, and they're talking about their future, and they want to get married, and blah, blah, blah. And then Aaron, I think, says something like, "You're going to be a terrific mother." And then Abra says, "You didn't know your mother very well, did you?" And then Aaron says, and this is exposition for the audience or the reader in the case of the novel, you know, and he explains that the mother died when they were very young and they didn't know her. And Cal knows differently, and that triggers something in him, and he sort of has a tantrum. And he throws all the ice in the ice house down the chute and destroys a lot of it. And that shot is, again, one of the most memorable shots in the film. It's a high-angle shot above James Dean as he's throwing ice down a chute. And, you know, the perspective we see all the way in the distance, we see the father and Will Hamilton at the bottom trying to figure out what the hell's going on, and they're yelling and screaming their heads off. And I love that scene too.
Yeah, it's a pretty good scene. Yeah. I mean, I think that you know, his fit also. I guess it's unspoken, but obviously it's because of his kind of affection towards Abra too. So hearing his brother and she speak about the relationship in the future, marriage, probably coupled with his frustration about his. Being unable to see his mother the day before, helps a lot.
You might be right, but I think they really only develop the Abra Cal thing later. Like, I think the first part of that is when she shows up to bring Aaron lunch at the lettuce fields, and Aaron is still in the field, so she has lunch with Cal. Like, I think that's the real beginning of that.
When I saw it, I definitely thought that, like, he had kind of, like, almost like a creepy affection for, or interest in her or something.
Well, that's like, funny because, right. You know, he sort of follows Kate around at the beginning, and he follows Aaron and Abra around, and then there's that, it's not a throwaway line, it's a very pointed, like, specific commentary. Like, Abra says to Aaron, like, "Do you know what the girls at school call him?" And is it the creeper or the stalker or something like that?
I don't remember.
I think it's creeper, actually. I think that's why you have that in your head. I'm pretty sure they call him the creeper.
Okay.
That I might be wrong on that. I'll make a note of it, you know, if... I'll check it and make a note of it in the show notes if I'm wrong. But I think it's the creeper. So, like, I thought that was hilarious, but at the same time, like, it sort of reinforces the idea that he's so socially awkward and uncomfortable with other people, and that he just sort of doesn't connect with anybody. He's kind of a loner. Even his relationship with his brother, like, in the beginning, there is a sense that Aaron loves Cal.
Well, he says it.
He does, but like
when Albert says, like, "Oh, like Cal scared your brother scares me," and he's like, "Oh, I love," and he's just almost like jovially says, "I love him."
I always feel, not always, but I watched the movie twice, and both times I kind of felt like Aaron loves that Cal makes him look good. And he loves, like, I think he has genuine affection for Cal, but I think he sort of revels in the idea that he's the favorite son, and that
wouldn't be, I guess.
Cal screws up, it makes his life easier, because then his father points to him and says, "Can't you be more like Aaron?" And I've known brothers who have had relationships kind of like that, where one of them is sort of the screw-up and one of them is sort of like the golden child. And I recognize that in that. But there's a little bit of darkness there, and the idea that, you know, that Aaron really, like, you know, I think he does love Cal, but I think there's a part of him that sort of likes having two steps up on him all the time.
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely see that in the way he, you know, as soon as, like, how quickly he turns on Cal.
Yeah.
Like, when he threatens to take something away from him.
Well, not only that, but, like, I think Aaron's a fascinating character, actually. Both the brothers, I think, grow and change throughout the movie. Aaron is a staunch pacifist, and as America enters World War I, you know, they have a big parade and a rally in the town, and he's sort of disgusted by it all. He's hiding behind a tree, watching the town sort of like cheerlead death and destruction. He defends the German friend of the family when the town, you know, sort of turns on them, which is a scene that also splits the brothers even more. And I like that. I like the idea that Aaron's really socially conscious and aware of what's happening, and doesn't approve, and that sort of affects, you know, his dynamic with Cal, who is, you know, profiting off the idea that we've gone to war. And, you know, like, the father openly, you know, you've got that great scene with the birthday party scene where he makes the money off the beans, he gives the money to his father, but Aaron undercuts it by announcing that he and Abra are engaged, which is something that Abra and Aaron discussed many times on screen, and I'm sure off. So it shouldn't have been a surprise, but because of the relationship that Abra and Cal have developed, Abra is now, like, surprised and taken aback by what he's doing. But the father rejects the money, and James Dean's character, Cal, doesn't understand the rejection because he doesn't understand the correlation between his father's principles and the idea that money was made, you know, by basically war profiteering. He doesn't understand that. The father lays it out. Aaron never does, but Aaron feels the same way. It's clear. Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm totally monopolizing this conversation right now.
That's okay. You know, you definitely are more prepared for this than I was.
You know what's really funny is that I did take like 6 pages of notes. I haven't looked at them once, actually, except to get the actors' names. So,
that's fine.
I think, to be honest, like, it just the way that you and I typically do this, I'm usually cramming like at the last minute to get a bunch of stuff in for the recording, and I feel like it doesn't sink in sometimes. And I, you know, the idea that we watched this movie like 2 weeks ago to do this episode, like, I really feel like it had time to sort of like, you know, kick around and for the ideas to come to the surface and things like that. I always feel like I can talk about a movie more and sometimes, and you be the judge, but sometimes more intelligently, like when I've had time for it to just kind of like sit and do its thing. Like I'm not even actively like, you know, like thinking about it, but now that we're talking about it, like I'm making connections and talking about things that I probably wouldn't have put in my notes anyway.
Sure. Yeah. I know what you mean. I think a lot of times there's something to be said about the gut reaction you have at the end of a film. And I think in many cases, that's probably like the truest, your truest opinion of the movie, like your immediate reaction afterwards. I think, but the time that you allow to discuss a film and let it percolate into your consciousness, especially, you know, if it's a movie that does that, as opposed to a movie that you immediately forget, I think a lot of those have a standard of quality, especially when it comes to discussion. I'm not sure if you watched East of Eden and discussed it with Chelsea or discussed it with anyone else. But I mean, to be honest, these podcasts are pretty much the only way I really kind of vent my opinions on most movies, to be honest with you, these days.
Yeah, now that our video store is closing.
Yeah, I guess so.
Rest in peace, Suncoast.
Yeah.
Did you work there the other day?
I worked there yesterday.
Yeah, how was it? Depressing?
Empty. Yeah. No, not really. It was wistful, bittersweet. It wasn't depressing. I think I've made my peace with it.
Hmm.
And I did steal something for you.
Oh yeah? Keep it a surprise, man. Don't tell me.
I wasn't gonna tell you.
Nice. I think there's still some of my stuff there, actually.
Your fan's still there.
Oh yeah, the box fan?
Yeah.
I think there's like some Star Wars signs from like that were store displays from like a Best Buy that I took in when we would decorate the store anytime we'd have like a Star Wars like event.
Oh yeah.
I think there's some of that stuff in the back room still.
Yeah, I think so. I'm gonna have to go through them. I did take that old Empire like square panel that we had above the door.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Yeah. The hangar bay.
For 80s, yeah.
God, you know how old that is? Jesus.
I don't know. I didn't realize, but it was folded.
That's almost as old as that microwave that you took from Dave Foster.
I didn't actually take it. It's still there.
I saw his Facebook post.
It was hilarious.
This sounds like a lot of inside baseball, but you know, if you've listened to the podcast, you know that Cesar and I worked at the same Suncoast for many years. And our old boss, Dave Foster, I always think of him as my old boss, but he's our old boss, had like an old, like, who made that microwave?
Panasonic.
A Panasonic fucking microwave that has like no digital output. It's just like a dial. It's super old. And it's dirty as fuck. It's so dirty. I hope you bleach the shit out of that before you take it and use it.
Nah, I'm just gonna start. I'm just gonna try to add new layers.
And the aroma when you open that thing up. Oh my god.
I don't even know. It's up there.
So many years of splatter.
You know, I think this bit that we're into right now. You guys can let us know if you think it's worth it. Maybe we should do an episode where we just talk about, like, Suncoast memories.
No, I like it better when they're just peppered in occasionally. But anyway, this microwave has got to be 25 years old, right?
I don't know. It feels like a million years old.
It's probably 20 years old, but it feels like 25 or 30 years old. But it still works. It's like, you know.
The microwave has got, like, I don't know, it looks like it came out of the 70s. Like
no, because it would have been huge. Like, a microwave that small is not, like... Like, in the 70s, right. All they had were, like, 30-inch microwaves that weighed 800 pounds.
It was made in yard at the time. Well, like, I guess you're right. Like, older microwaves weren't set top either. They were, like, installed, right? So...
I don't know.
I think so. I watched this. But
I guess Dave didn't know that it was still there, right? So you contacted him and asked him if you could have it, and he put a Facebook post saying like he's not sure like like if he's happier that it still works or that you know, whatever, I don't know. What did he say?
He said it was like he said, "I don't know what amuses me more, the fact that someone remembered that it was his,
yeah,
or the fact that it still worked."
So, hi, Dave Foster. We love you.
Love you, Dave.
Yeah. Mwah.
Man, kissing noises. Man, that's a first for this podcast. Sorry,
all right. Everybody. So, speaking of kissing, let's dial it back to East of Eden.
What a tangent. Okay, terrific.
So the relationship that is, you know, budding relationship between Cal and Abra, sort of like hits a peak in a scene where Cal is. This is funny because apparently, and I don't know if this is supposed to indicate that there is racism against like Mexican workers or something like that. But Cal has, in a couple scenes with Abra, he's sort of hanging around with like, you know, pretty Mexican girls who work in the lettuce farm. Or in the second case, the bean farm. And anytime Abra's around, he sort of like ignores them, like they're not there. And you know, directs his attention towards Abra. And so like he's sort of like, I don't know, I wouldn't call him a ladies' man, but you know, it seems like he definitely gets attention from these ladies. And when he goes to the carnival with one of the Mexican girls, and then as soon as Abra shows up, he ditches the Mexican girl completely.
He leaves her holding everything.
Yeah, he just wants a cigar, and he's like, "Hold my cigar," and then he goes over to Abra, and then he ditches her and walks around with Abra for an hour. What an asshole.
Yeah, he even sees her later on.
Yeah. Yeah, and well, it's funny because she, like, waits, and then, like once he and Abra, like, I guess they get to the Ferris wheel or whatever, like, she confronts him and is like, "Where have you been?" And, like, I don't remember if he actually says anything, but then he still gets on the Ferris wheel with Abra.
Right in front of her.
It's hilarious and sad all at the same time.
Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't necessarily read any, like, racial overtones or undertones into, like, that sequence of stuff.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if it was maybe because, like, because Abra's a white girl. And the Mexican girls are, you know, forgive me, brown girls, that perhaps, like, he was acting like they weren't his friends because it would make him seem like he was consorting with, you know, with Mexican girls. I don't know. But it just seemed, it seemed a little odd. You know, I mean, if it had been, you know, one Mexican girl and one white girl, I wouldn't think twice about it, but both of them, it's two different Mexican girls.
See, I also kind of got, like, the impression that Abra, she became more comfortable with him. I mean, I guess Cal really starts a transformation once he decides to go full in to support his father's lettuce refrigeration venture.
Right.
So, in that position, you know, you don't necessarily see him do a ton of hard work, aside for some lines that kind of give exposition on how hard he's been working to make his father's endeavor a success.
Yeah, I love that line where the two workers are saying, "This is never going to work. Like, this guy's crazy." And then Cal walks up and he goes, "It's going to work. It's got to work." And then Cal walks away, and there's that line where, like, the workers are like, "Well, if it doesn't work, it's not that kid's fault. He works harder than I've ever seen anybody work before in my life."
It looked like he had a lot of energy, though.
It was a very hokey scene, like, yeah, you know.
I think, him working really hard, probably, I want to say, because it definitely seemed like it gave him self-confidence. Like, the hard work kind of like begins to change him. So I think
I think it's like, more, I mean, you're definitely right, but I think there's also a bit of him just sort of like wholeheartedly devoting himself to being the son his father would want him to be at that point.
What he thinks his father wants him to be.
Well, I think he's right, though. You know, like they have that scene with the coal chute where he steals the coal chute and uses it for them to move lettuce from one truck to another easier. And his father loves the idea, and he says, you know, did you come up with that? And when James Dean says, yes, I came up with that idea, the look of pride on his face, knowing that his, you know, that he's actually earning his father's adoration in that moment is incredibly, you know, there's the happiness is very clear. And then his father even says, I'm something to the effect of, I'm very pleased with the way that you've been taking, you know, an interest in this business with me, Cal, you know, like, you know, maybe I was wrong about you.
Thanks, Dad. But going back to what I was trying to say earlier.
Yeah, sorry.
Abra, like, it feels to me like she, when he starts working hard, and he, I guess, like, hey, you know, tangentially related, is that, you know, when he begins acting like the way he thinks his father wants him to be, that's when Abra also starts to express interest in him. So, like, his qualities that make him more comparable to Aaron are is kind of like the start of her and his, like, I guess, mutual attraction to each other.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, you know, they have that scene.
That's what gets, I guess, the girls. I mean, she would always tease him by saying, girls follow you around during the film. She says it like two or three times, if I remember correctly. But I think, like, his confidence and his success with women may also, you know, be one of the reasons she kind of starts seeing him in a new light.
Yeah, that's definitely a universal thing, I think. That same scene that you're talking about, I think, where they're in the field, and, you know, she's playing with the flower, and he's sort of like rolling over, and they're talking before Aaron shows up. That's the scene where she tells the story about her father and the diamond ring, and it's sort of in that scene where they sort of find a connection together. I think, you know, that they both have daddy issues in a way. They both have broken families. So I think there's a lot of connections that you can draw that kind of like makes it easy to understand why they would be attracted to one another. And so that's why it's so much more heartbreaking when they're up on the Ferris wheel and they have that moment where she puts her hand on his and he leans in and kisses her, and you know, they kiss for, like, I don't know, it's like 2 seconds. It's like a real kiss. And then she pulls herself away and says, you know, I love Aaron, I really do. And, like, that moment for Dean when he sort of, like, silently turns and you can see...
he contorts his body a bit.
Yeah, you can see the disappointment and hurt on him. I don't think there's guilt. I don't think he's really considering Aaron at all. I think it's just a matter of, like, he's not only been rejected by his father and his mother at certain points of the film, but now he's being rejected by the woman that he has feelings for as well. And then he's about to be rejected by his brother later in that very scene, because that's the scene where the town sort of, like, gets crazy and they follow the German guy home, and Aaron sticks up for the German guy, and then when he sees that the townspeople are pushing Aaron around, Cal jumps down and just gets in there and starts fighting. And it turns into sort of a riot. not a big one, but a little bit of a riot. And then afterwards, which we haven't talked about...
Like, settle everything with, yeah, like, a quick word.
We haven't talked about Burl Ives yet, which we have to, but... Because Burl Ives is the fucking man. But yeah, after that scene, like, Aaron resents the way that Cal came in just punching away. And it's an extension of Aaron's pacifism and the idea that he's against this war. And so they have it out, and that ends with Cal sort of beating up his brother. You know, he punches him like 3 or 4 times, right?
Yeah.
And Abra has to tell him to stop. And so, like, you know, at that point...
That's pretty much the first moment when Aaron kind of, like, also turns...
Crazy?
Against his brother. Yeah. He becomes more frantic. So.
Yeah, he seems very much more wild-eyed once that scene... Well, like, there's a great shot in that scene after the riot starts, because Aaron's not pushing or hitting or kicking anybody, and he's just sort of wading through and looking at the townspeople, like, going crazy. And he starts to go crazy in a much different way, in a more psychological way. He's appalled by what he sees. That shot is another one that really sticks out for me. And it's a wonderfully staged and directed shot by Kazan, who, to be honest, I think this movie's hit or miss visually. It's very dated as far as, like, the color, the Warner color that they used. I don't like the look of it. It's very unnatural looking. But there are certain shots in the movie that I really love, and that's one of them, along with a couple of the other ones that I've mentioned already. I don't know where we were going with that. But, but hey, Burl Ives, Sam the Sheriff... is such an odd, like, he's almost like a Greek chorus character. You know what I mean? Like, he just kind of shows up and has information that people needs, and, you know, and then that's it.
He's like, never mind. It was going to be a bad comparison.
that's all right. I make bad comparisons all the time.
Well, I'm not gonna, like, give it air.
Don't be shy, Cesar. Come on.
Burl Ives, don't you think that he might be some kind of, like underworld boss or something?
Maybe the way people react, like, at the end of that riot, like, the only reason that riot stops is because Sam the Sheriff shows up and one of the guys grabs him and is gonna hit him. Until he sees that it's Sam the Sheriff, and then, like, everybody stops. Like, it's almost comical if it wasn't so arresting. You know what I mean? No pun intended.
Yeah. Something like, well, I mean, earlier in the film, when James Dean goes to, he kind of sneaks into his mother's gambling hall / brothel, you know, they still don't know who he is in relation to Kate. He gets arrested, and Sam goes to pick him up. But, like, for some reason, in Sam's drawer, he's got, like, messages and, like, books from his mother.
I made a fucking note about that. That's so funny. Why does he have a picture in his drawer of Cal's parents?
I'm wondering, is Sam... And Sam doesn't necessarily dress like an officer of the law.
I almost spit my water out.
So, you know, maybe the Burl Ives portrayal is that, you know, he's got, like... maybe he's in some kind of maybe dirty officer relationship, you know, turns a blind eye to what's going on in Monterey, and he just happens to have, like, Kate stuff, maybe, like, blackmail, just ready to go.
Well, to be honest, I like the way you think, Cesar, but chances are that the brothel's still legal activity at that point. So he's probably not turning a blind eye to, like, that. He seems to be ready to arrest people when he needs to. But I like the idea of him as a crime boss. That's amazing. Because every time I see Burl Ives, all I can think about is, you know, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Is it Sam the Snowman?
Yeah. It looked pretty grim for poor Rudolph.
Look pretty grim for poor old Caleb.
But, like, even at the end, Sam just shows up and he's like, Aaron's gone crazy. He got into a bunch of fights, and now he's going to enlist in the army. Better go get him. Like,
and he does, like, whatever. He does the East of Eden line, too, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. Yep. Yeah.
How important is this? This guy might be, like, he might be, like, Stan Lee in the Marvel movies.
He is. The Watcher. He's the center of the East of Eden universe.
Yes. Uh-huh. All these characters, like, revolve around him. What you don't know is that Sam the Sheriff, he's the one who instigated, like, the breakup between Kate and Adam.
He's been banging Kate for years.
He gave Kate the pistol that she used to shoot Adam.
I love the idea that she shot Adam. Like,
I mean, when they talk about it, it's only really, like, two or three lines. So if you kind of, like, if you're not paying attention in that moment, it's easy to miss. And then, like, when she says, you know, why'd you shoot him? It's like, I shot him for whatever reason. So it's easy to miss it and to be taken surprise when they bring it up the second time.
Yeah. Well, that's during the scene where she gives him the okay to invest with Will Hamilton. Mm-hmm. The idea of the shooting comes up, and he says, you know, why did you shoot him? And she says, because he wouldn't let me go. Like, and so it was, you know, and this is an obvious point, but it was about freedom and the same kind of freedom that Cal's looking for from his father as well. So, I'm glad that was not like a foreshadowing that Cal would shoot his father later in the movie or something like that, because that would have been a downer.
Yeah.
All right, I just want a couple things. I like Kazan's use of, like, Dutch angles, which he essentially does only to illustrate the imbalance of the family dynamic. So, like, every time Cal and his father are having an argument, they use Dutch angles.
You're going to have to, like, Dutch angle, you might want to explain that for me. I'm not familiar with the term.
Oh, well, like a canted camera.
Oh, kind of like in the Batman television series?
Yeah, so you're just taking the camera and tilting it so that the angle is off.
Okay.
Sorry. Good point. What are you talking about? Everyone's got Google. Look it up. I'm not here to explain everything. I'm not Mr. Encyclopedia Brown.
Yeah, you're right. No one wants to listen to you speak.
That's true. That's why I speak so much.
Yeah.
And so often. Anything else that you want to get into on this?
I don't know if I have anything else to really add to it. I think, probably one of my favorite scenes is the scene when, going after their lettuce venture. I guess Cal's father, he tries to buy, like, a Model T vehicle.
Yeah, when he thinks that he's going to be rich, yeah.
I remember thinking that was pretty amusing. I can't remember what's the name of the car, like, I guess the mechanic who was trying to sell it to him or teaching him how to use the crank.
I don't know.
I don't remember. But, like, I was like, man, driving was a pain in the ass back then.
Yeah. Yeah. Thankfully now we can start our car from inside the house if we want to.
Some of us.
Well, mine doesn't do that, but I mean, we have the technology. We can build him. We have the technology.
All right. Well, how about you? Do you have any final thoughts?
I don't know.
I don't think, to be honest, I don't think I'm going to really top, you know, Sam as the underworld crime boss.
No. I think that's great. I want to see that movie, though. I want the CGI Burl Ives as a crime boss, Godfather-like crime boss.
Let's see, I'm going to look at his, I'm going to have to check his filmography and see if there's some creative editing that can go on.
There you go. As far as the movie as a whole, you know, being that this was the first time I watched this movie, I obviously it's worth watching. You know, it's an important film for being, you know, one of the only three movies that James Dean did, and James Dean's performance is very good. You know, it's certainly understandable that he was going to be shot into stardom from this film, because this was actually, let me see, this was the only one of Dean's films to be released before his death, and the only one he was able to view in its entirety before he died in a car accident. So this was released first, but Rebel Without a Cause and Giant were already in the can. I completely forgot what I was going to say after that.
Okay.
Anyway, Jo Van Fleet won an Oscar for her performance in the film. James Dean was actually nominated for his performance, but that year the Oscar went to Ernest Borgnine for Marty, which is a great movie. You know, very good performance by him in that. If you haven't seen Marty, you should watch that. I think on a technical level, I think it's really hit or miss. Like I mentioned earlier, the look of these like early to mid 50s like colorized epics is a bit of a turnoff to me in many ways because it looks so unnatural. And I think at this point, CinemaScope was developed by 20th Century Fox, and the first use of it was 1951. This came out in 1955. But it still was not something that people were comfortable and familiar enough with to really utilize that rectangular frame. And I think that Kazan has moments in the film where he does a good job using the frame, and I think there are moments in the film where he doesn't use the frame well. You know, I like some of the shots, like the elongated angles in the elongated shadows in Kate's brothel, and Dean pushing the ice down the chute, and a few others. But there's as much, I think, problematic technical work in the film as there is great technical work in the film. Two of the things that I think it's easy now in hindsight to look at them and say that they're not well done. It's another thing that when the technology is new, but there's a scene of James Dean on top of like the train car that's like obviously like rear projection or blue screen that looks horrible. I mean I would have cut it out. It looks so bad.
He's tucked inside his
jacket, yeah, a sweater. And he's talking to himself. He's like, I should have gone in there. I should have gone in, you know. But it's a horrible shot. It's terrible. And then his confrontation with the Timothy Carey character who plays Joe, who is sort of like Kate's right-hand man.
Yeah, bodyguard or...
Yeah, well, that does not sound like Timothy Carey's voice in the movie at all. It sounds like they overdubbed him. I might be wrong, but the sound work in those early scenes where Dean and Timothy Carey are talking outside the brothel, it's not synced properly, and it just...
I think those are also, like, long shots, too, so they didn't have, like microphones that they could fit because they're a little bit farther out. So microphones necessarily wouldn't have been out of frame.
Yeah, it's a little bit jarring and very obvious, though. And, like, you know, like I said, this is a movie from 1955. And, yeah, the CinemaScope process, or in this case it's not CinemaScope because it wasn't Fox, but it was Panavision, you know, to use widescreen imagery was still something that was brand new, and this was Kazan's first time using a wide angle frame. So you know there's going to be some growing pains, but I think you know it's a little up and down for me. You know I don't think I'm going to rush to revisit this anytime soon. Although I do think it's a good movie, and I think it's worth watching. I think there was, you know, I think we're leaving a little on the table that I think there's a lot to talk about as far as like the religious implications of the film and the anti-war sentiments and things like that. But you know, it's only an hour show, so
yeah. Well, a little bit more than an hour at this point, I guess.
I'd rather leave some on the table than drag it out. So let's
okay. That's call it.
Let's call it a day.
Alright.
Cool. Where can everyone find you on the internet, Mr. Cesar?
You can find me on filmsmash.com, Asian film news and reviews, or on Twitter at Junior Biho.
Cool. And you can find me at Setting the Frame on Twitter and on the Celluloid Jelly Facebook page. If you remember, if you're not, you know, make sure you apply for membership. It's not a rigorous process. You're usually just in. So that's great. So next time we'll do a 2017 wrap up and favorites and talk about what we want to see in 2018. And then the week after we will do John Woo's seminal action movie, Hard Boiled. So great.
Look forward to it, everyone.
All right, man.
Celluloid Jelly was recorded using Google Hangouts, mixed using Apple's GarageBand software, and hosted by Podbean. For any inquiries related to Celluloid Jelly, please email settingtheframe@gmail.com.